Hello and welcome to the LGBT Family and Games Community Podcast. My name is James, and today we are joined by a very special guest, Victoria Peltier. Victoria is a 20-plus year corporate executive and board director. She is currently a managing director at Accenture, nicknamed the Turnaround Queen by former colleagues and employers. Victoria inspires and empowers her teams and clients to change mindsets and drive growth in business, leadership, and culture. As someone who does not subscribe to the status quo, she is always ready for new challenges, becoming one of the youngest chief operating officers at the age of 24, a president by 35, and a CEO by age 41. Meanwhile, doesn't look a day over 30. Victoria was recognized as one of the 2023 Woman of Influence by South Florida Business Journal, 2022 Top 30 Most Influential Business Leaders in Tech by CIO Look, 2022 Most Influential Entrepreneur of the Year by World Magazine, 2021's Top 50 Business Leader in Technology by Insight Magazine, and a Mentor of the Year by Women in Communications and Technology in 2020. HBC Bank also awarded her the Diversity and Inclusion in Innovation Award in 2019, and she was IBM's number one global social seller ranked by LinkedIn in 2019 and 2020. Wow.
Phew, sorry that was so long, James.
Yeah, you're good. You are moving all the time. And in fact, when we were trying to schedule this, like you were saying, what, like 2 months out if we couldn't schedule like today or next Tuesday, right?
Yeah, it was a little bit crazy lately and some travel upcoming. Yeah.
So like with your job, what does like an average day in the life look like for you?
Literally has changed so dramatically because of the pandemic. I'm used to being a bit of a road warrior. And so although things certainly have opened up and many clients want to go back to in-person meetings, I also do public speaking on the side. And so getting back into standing on physical stages, a ton of it, it's still hybrid. So I've actually been able to control significantly more of my calendar. Like I'm a fitness fanatic. I make sure my calendar is blocked early morning. So I'm at the gym, but I have time to get home and like shower and work out. And I was joking about the big curly hair of mine. So I don't look like a wet dog. Like I, you know, don't get on camera until a certain time. Otherwise it's then back to back to back to back conference calls. So I live by my calendar during the week. So my biggest goal on the weekend is not to have to live by that calendar. Like I don't want to be forced to be anywhere at any particular time unless it's very much by choice.
Completely understand. I can totally relate. So as a professional, you're obviously very successful, despite having not a traditional upbringing. Can you just give us a brief overview of what your life has been like and then how that's led you to be who you are today?
Yeah, I actually attribute it very much my upbringing. I refer to it as my why. For any of your listeners who are familiar with Simon Sinek, his Start With Why, that kind of viral TED talk that he did. And my upbringing is mine. And so I'm born to a drug addicted teenage mother. She was exceptionally abusive to me, pushing me upstairs, downstairs, carelessness, not intentionality, but I had a cigarette from her in my eye and I wore a patch for months. And thankfully, there was a couple that she often would give me to after certain episodes. And the last time I remained in her care, actually, she called the people that ultimately became my parents and said, come and get her before I kill her. And my mom is the woman that raised me, not Julie, the woman that birthed me, said, we want to take her away from you. We'd like to care and love for her. And so that was great. But then I was pretty scarred as a young child around not only the abuse, but I think a little bit more the insecurity and fear of rejection that caused a lot more so in my like personal relationships than as I grew older. But I had a ton of other challenges. My parents from a socioeconomic standpoint were, you know, Laura, my dad was a school janitor. My mom was a secretary. So there, although I didn't ever go without food or clothing, there was just not enough money for vacations, for even actually my school trips on many, many occasions. I was raped at 14. Like there was just a bunch of things. So those caused me to be exceptionally resilient. But also in terms of my career and what I've achieved, those are the things that drive me. My mom said to me, I think when I was 11 or 12 years old, Tori, you need to do better than us. And I think she meant by education and from a vocation standpoint. She didn't need to say that to me because I think innately, without the words at 11 or 12, I was like, I'm determined to be better than the biology in Julie's world or the circumstance kind of being raised into a lower socioeconomic status. And so I started working at 11 and then, wow, you know, kind of went through there. So that's what drives me. And I wouldn't have shared the story so openly until I started doing much, much more coaching and mentoring. And I realized I was doing everyone a disservice in coaching them on their career success and what would drive them forward if I didn't actually tell them how I got and what my drive was, where it was from.
Yeah. And you even shared a story. I can't remember if it was part of the book, because I did read the book, by the way, is Unstoppable: Stories of Change Makers Who Dare to Make a Difference. And Victoria has the first chapter, right? Is all you. And yeah, I think you shared a story in there about coming to the office after having seen a movie and you were emotional about that movie, but previously you had kind of bottled up all of those emotions and were kind of shut off to the world. So you've learned to really self-assess and be more expressive since then.
Yeah. I talk a lot now around how to overcome adversity and develop a healthy level of resilience. And I think for some people that, you know, they will define themselves as being resilient, they can withstand a lot, but not in a way that I think is healthy for them. And I was, to some extent, that unhealthy version of that. So compartmentalizing. So when things happened, you put it to the side and you just move forward, you never really process and deal with that, and particularly those emotions. So that was one. And two is there was a great fear for me to be vulnerable to other people. So I know that particularly in a work context, in part also because I became an executive so young and I was the only woman for many years at the executive table as well. So you add those dynamics and queer. So in my first exec role, I was the youngest by probably two decades. I was the only woman. I was the only LGBT member. That coupled with all my insecurity and me not learning how to kind of deal with some of the, you know, the emotions or fear to share them with others, you know, I never showed it. I wore a mask. You know, it's like stepped into the office and all business all the time. You will not see me be like emotional or vulnerable at all because I don't want anyone to feel like they can poke holes as a result of knowing that about me. And so that was something I needed to learn. And so that's one thing I'll tell people, although I think there's innate in me some kind of a DNA that, you know, fight or flight, I'm the fight, I'm there. But I also think the ability to build the muscle to be resilient in a very different way. And that's feeling the emotion, processing the emotion, being really self-reflective, and doing things like modeling the thinking or the language or the actions that you need to take to ultimately move yourself forward and whatever that sort of goal or objective is.
Absolutely. And you talked about being a queer executive. So let's get into that a little bit. What part of LGBTQ do you identify as, and what was that like? When did you come out?
Yeah, so it's where I sat on the spectrum has, you know, changed over the years. I came out at 14 while in a Catholic high school in Calgary, Alberta, which is Western Canada. I jokingly refer to it as Texas North. No, nowhere near as conservative, but it's an oil and gas town. Like, it's really, there's not a lot of diversity there, or there certainly wasn't, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so my best friend and I remember like disclosing this to her. I'm fortunate, really liberal mom who, by the way, I didn't even tell until I was 20, but in part because they're like, I tried going to a gay bar and there really wasn't, like, and I was too young anyways, but in Calgary. And I continued to date mostly guys at that point, even though I declared myself bisexual, but in part by lack of opportunity to date girls at that point. And then I got relocated right. I graduated quite early. So I graduated high school around 16 and went to university at 17. So wow, by the time I was coming out of university at 20, I got relocated across the country to Toronto, which I'm very proud of that city. They were just voted like the most diverse city in the world just a number of weeks ago, actually. And so one, I love the diversity. And the funny thing is the bank that I worked for, they put me up for the first month until I found an apartment at a hotel near the office that I was going to be working at, which was on Church Street, which is the gay mecca for Toronto. Like, gay, okay, you know, Church and Wellesley is like the epicenter. So here I am staying, and like my first friend at work is a gay man. And so all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, like, here's my people. And so I just was so immersed in the community there that, and I started finally like dating women and told my mom. And funny enough, my mom said to me, she goes, just remember, Tori, like, women can be jerks too. Like, that was her advice to me. And it was like, okay, move on. But then, you know, I started dating women and I was just like, oh my goodness. And so then I put myself in the L category. I said, no, I'm a lesbian. And, you know, I met the woman that became my wife when I was 22 and she was 35. And then at some point, I think as I just sort of matured and got more comfortable in my skin period, I think I just like matured and grew up a little bit. I sort of went, well, no, I'm actually probably like, you know, bisexual. And although my younger one has subsequently said to me that I need to say I'm pansexual. So I now just say I'm queer. And that means, okay, you know, I'm not straight. So that's where I fall on the spectrum.
Okay. And so you actually mentioned that your youngest is on the LGBT spectrum as well. So
yeah.
it's all part of the family.
So I now think we have like the coolest family. Although my ex-wife and I had separated, she passed away a couple of years after that from her second round of cancer, which is really sad. I took my children away shortly after she passed because she passed just a couple of months before Christmas. We went away on vacation and I ended up meeting a man and my younger one invited him to join us for dinner saying, you can't be alone at Christmas time. And so Jordan is my younger one, would like to think that my now husband and I are together because of Jordan. So I have two children. I gave birth to both of them. The first one is a very straight, like cisgendered and Viking looking son, Zoe, Zoe meaning life, just because being adopted, they're my blood. So the symbolism around that. So Zoe, and then Jordan was born a girl and started to be fairly male presenting. Initially I used to think it was just about emulating Dee, my ex-wife. And she came out at, I use the pronoun she, because when I talk about her, when she was female presenting, and now I'll use he, him, or they, them. And so at 11, she came out to me saying, I think I might be gay. Like I like girls. And at 14, she had her first girlfriend. I actually helped her learn how to flirt a little bit because she was missing some cues. I was coaching her hockey team and it was a fellow hockey player. And then literally just 6 months ago, after multiple conversations over the years around gender identity, Jordan said, no, I think I've just kind of been denying it. I think actually I want to transition. And so had asked to use they, them, or he, him pronouns. And so I joked with Jordan. I'm like, at least you don't have to change your name because Jordan can go either way.
Yeah, works both ways.
That's so right.
So as a parent, somebody who identifies as trans right now has been tumultuous at best in the United States. I think over 450 different pieces of legislation are currently in process across the U.S. that are considered anti-LGBT, specifically anti-drag or anti-trans bills. Are you seeing that where you guys are, or
yeah? What are your thoughts? So this for me is I am a U.S. resident, permanent resident, but a proud Canadian. And this is where at times, like when I travel the world, I make sure I tell people that I'm a Canadian citizen, in part because I'm just saddened by what is happening here in the U.S. And I've been in and out of Toronto and New York most of my career, moved back to the U.S. in 2019 to New York, and we moved almost 2 years ago now to Florida. So,
you're in my boat. You are in my boat.
Yes. So, but I mean, I live in Miami, in Miami Beach, right?
Okay.
So there's
so not
a little different. It's better here. And when Jordan graduated high school last year and was, you know, vice president of the Gay Straight Alliance, you know, and the fact that they had it at that school is great. And so it was much more supportive here. But then, Pride is right now, April 1st to the 16th, because it's too hot to do it in June here. And so like last night I was out at like our LGBT Chamber of Commerce Pride event. And there was a trans woman that was there, and someone in drag as well. And so it was almost done in secrecy, like coming out just. And so when I see that, given like, I'm going to be interested to see how Sunday Pride Parade is going to play out. Like, what is DeSantis going to do? Who's going to be here, you know, to kind of monitor all of those things, the don't gay, you know, say gay, everything is just, for me, it's so incredibly, incredibly sad and disappointing. Not in this state and in many, many parts of this country on the whole.
100% agree. I mean, me and my husband, we love where we're at. We're in Central Florida and we just moved into a new house a couple of years ago and we absolutely love it. But yeah, it's been DeSantis's war on wokeness, diversity, equity, inclusion has just been, to me, it's just gone off the rails. we're in a different time.
And you know what? I just think there's so much that the country could be focused on versus women's reproductive rights, absolutely, LGBT, and taking on rolling back and taking all of these steps back when we've got this national debt crisis, the fact that we've got an aging population and we need to look at Social Security and how do we fund these things, to look at world relations. I just, you know, that we're so insular and focusing and rolling back the clock decades on some of these things for me is just so shocking, quite frankly.
Yep. Oh, I like to call it hocus pocus, change the focus. So they, they can divert attention away from their, you know, inability to solve actual true problems onto a minority group. So it's unfortunate. But what has this been like? Because you're in the diversity, equity, and inclusion line of work. So what is this like for you from a business standpoint? Like, you know, how do you handle employees in Florida when policies like these start happening?
Well, it's interesting. One of the reasons I loved joining Accenture, right? They'd recruited me second time around from IBM, which is also strong on some diversity values. Accenture truly, like I see a lot. One, we have a female CEO. Many of her direct reports are either people of color or women. At the executive level, we hit 47%. This year. So I love that we, from a values-based perspective, and have taken demonstrable steps to move the needle forward on a multitude of fronts. So that part is great. But it was really interesting to hear the chatter when you look on Fishbowl, for example, I mean, anonymous, but to see like what people post there, or to see even the pushback, particularly in Florida and Texas, on things like when we had a vaccine mandate. And so it actually started to see it stem from that to just kind of seeing more of these conversations. The good news is we have leaders who take very bold stances on social politics and Roe v. Wade and things like that. So I love that. But it's all this other sort of chatter. And I do, as you said, I kind of work in this space. A big part of what I've done is I've been involved in DE&I since before there were like employee resource groups. And in part because of my lived experience, but also I realized this is really good for business and I lead really large teams. We'll spend time with, you know, executives at other companies talking about how to build intentionality into their DEI programs across a multitude of fronts, not just workforce. It needs to be bigger than that. And there's such a struggle. I will tell you, I was pretty bold even for like Accenture. We announced a few weeks ago layoffs of 19,000 people. And about 800 of them are executives. And I started to hear and see on both anonymously and otherwise people talking about how white males are being discriminated against right now because they're the ones who are going to be let go and all of this. And they also use that same chatter when they talk about the promotion cycle as well. And so I raised that we had an executive call and our CEO for North America was on and there was in our chat, he was asking questions, what are we hearing? And someone put in there, more around like at the lower levels, we manage things on the bench, like who has work. I mean, think management consulting, you get assigned to engage project to project. And we're just talking about the reality is a lot of the diversity, high like employees, a lot of them are on the bench because there's still a lot of who we hired you, but you need to build a network and be known. And then I tagged on this whole, like, we need to quell this down. And he immediately jumped on it. And so he was saying the right things, but I took to LinkedIn and wrote an article and I'm like, let's stop this. Like, let's stop debating the, you know, the data that's out there. The Fortune 500 companies, only 53 women and are CEOs and only 6 Black CEOs. Like, stop debating the data. Like, it's there. So I have zero tolerance for it.
Yeah, no, I can completely relate. The company that I work for, it's a tough industry. I'm in the battery industry. So yeah. Women are very underrepresented in that industry and oftentimes get relegated to certain types of roles that follow kind of these prejudices and gender identity. But every time I'm actually part of an independent franchise location. So every time we hire, I'm always looking for diversity. Our women employees have always been phenomenal performers. We all think a little bit differently. It brings different backgrounds into the mix. And it just, it makes for a more successful company long term. So I completely agree. And I think I saw your blog post recently about how bracing ourselves for all these layoffs that are specifically going to happen in tech companies and, you know, companies that leverage debt a lot.
That was the follow on. I did a very specific one immediately, like within the first week, post some of the Accenture announcements. But then it was like, we need to be, I use a phrase a lot where I talk about strategic intentionality. And so my coaching and guidance to the leaders of the world, as we're forced just to look at restructuring and layoffs during this time, is to be really mindful of not taking steps back that we've made in terms of the progress, in terms of the diversity of the workforce in these upcoming layoffs, and make sure we're really, really balanced around that.
So in your ideal world, what do you use as your metrics when you have to make those? Because those are tough decisions to make when you're having to lay off people. It's not fun. Nobody wants to do that. So what do you look for? What's your guiding star?
I've been a part of 18 mergers and acquisitions, and those almost always, they come at least with restructuring. So you're at least going to be, if not laying off people, you're moving people around, and not all of them are happy about what that looks like. And I've often usually run the operations of a lot of organizations, which is where the majority of the people sit, the highest count of FTE across the business. So I've been in a position to do many restructures and layoffs. There's a way to go about it from a very mature leadership and diversity lens. And so, first of all, there's like, nowadays more and more, we need to stop thinking about like the job title, and it's actually skills. So we need to be looking at what are the skills needed in our business, not just for today, but understanding where our business strategy is going. And as I mean, every company is a technology company, whether you are or you not. We use technology to enable the way we work and the way our customers buy from us. We're all technology companies. And so this digital transformation requires very different skills for today, and it's going to continue to evolve. And so think about it from skills today, and then how are we evolving, and then doing an analysis of what do we have in our business today that meets that? And also, who has the propensity to learn? Because that's super important. You might not actually need everyone to have the skills today, or in 2 years from now, you know you're going to need this many more. Well, who can learn? Who has that aptitude and capability? So it's doing an assessment from that standpoint, this kind of skills matrix. Who has those skills? And then trying to make sure you've got this an optimal blend of diversity. And again, we're just talking mostly about like gender and sexuality, but there's the intersectionality of religion, neurodiversity, physical abilities, veteran status, to quite honestly live the lived experience we all have. Did you live and work in different countries? What from a socioeconomic status, or what experience did you have in your past that causes you to operate or work in different ways? So that, I mean, that's why it's so, there's so much richness from having like incredible multifaceted diversity. And so as you build that skills matrix and doing the assessment of what do you have, and then trying to do like this balance, and it's tough. I'm not saying that's easy to do this, because you're looking at, you know, and there's a lot of lens around, you know, age even as well, particularly in these layoffs right now. And so it's kind of, what does that blend look like? And I also think, forget layoffs for a second, but also how do you leverage that when we think about how do we grow our business? Who's our potential talent? And actually, it's proven that usually women certainly, and people of color, usually rate themselves lower on their skills than the average white male does. Women typically won't apply for jobs unless they believe they have like 9 or 10 out of the skills listed, whereas men do it at like 5 or 6. And so this is where the intentionality, me as a leader, I need to recognize that and be comfortable, even if there is a skill gap, how do I bridge that skill gap by giving them the tools, the learning, the education, or my coaching to get them closer to the 9 or 10 out of 10, and or build their confidence because they already have the skills.
Absolutely. So, and you work on personal branding. You do a lot of talks. What do those talks look like? Like what do you try to accomplish when you're speaking with an organization about building personal brand and.
Yeah. So they're kind of two pieces there. So I do a lot of work around personal brand, and that's because I've been very focused on my own and my team. I mean, recognize that we all want to do business with people we like, trust, and therefore we want to do business with, or we want to buy from if you're the end consumer, or we want to work for if you're an employee-employer relationship. So who we are, and brand is more than our job title in the company we work for. So it's bigger than that. Who am I as an individual? What are my values? How am I as a leader? What things do I stand for? And then also what kind of legacy or impact do I want to have? Like those are things that we need to be thinking about as our own personal brand. So I do work within my own business around that and my teams around it, but I do give talks on that. But I also do public speaking on a multitude of things, one of which is just personal brand. I've been speaking for 20 years, and the first 10 was almost exclusively related at like business conferences related to the industry or the functional areas that I knew well, or as a leader talking about a leadership topic. And then 10 years ago, I got way more comfortable sharing my story on stages. I'd shared it certainly in smaller audiences, like one-on-one or small groups, but now kind of sharing it much more broadly. And so that's kind of morphed into talking about overcoming adversity and being resilient. And what have I learned to sort of get me? So I am where I am from a career perspective, not just because I have this why that caused me to be really driven. There's a number of things that have gotten me that propelled me there. So I share that story, but I also talk about the kind of environments we all want to work in or people we want to work for. So how do you, you know, be kind of a human, like human centric leader, particularly now post pandemic, the hustle nation where it was all focused on like productivity, performance, that's not working. That's why people are choosing to exit companies. Yeah. They want to balance. They want to work for kind of leaders. So talking about that, talking about DE&I, what does that look like? And then there's specialties within technology or functional areas or other things that I know that I might still talk about. But the stuff that gets me like super like jazzed is talking about leadership and culture and this diversity work, or talking about adversity, or, you know, so I actually do some just even on negotiating. How do you negotiate for yourself, particularly from a career perspective?
So do you have any advice for the young part of LGBT? So people that are just entering the workforce, how do they create a brand for themselves and strive just like you have?
What I would say is don't wait to build a brand until you're like in your 30s or 40s or whenever you think is the appropriate time. The reality is I think a lot of people think that their performance will speak for itself, but if your leader goes, who's then advocating for you? So you need to build this brand much more broadly. And again, you want to be known for someone who's agile in this kind of environment that you can be flexible, that you're like good to work with, that you're like integrity or values driven. Like all of those things are things about your brand. So start on that like immediately as you enter the workforce. But it's also okay that you pivot or change over time. I mean, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. That was my plan from like age 11 or 12. And it turns out I loved the business world. So when I came out of university, I thought, oh, I'm just going to take a year off. The bank I work for has promoted me. Well, it turns out I really loved it. So I pivoted. And then at some point in my 30s, when I was just hustle to get as high as I could on the corporate ladder, I realized it's about legacy and impact. And so I'm going to tell the listeners that start it now. Build your brand that is very much what did you go to school for? What are you well educated, or what do you know? What experience do you have? But who are you as a person? And I think you need to do that authentically and share stories, and always be mindful of like what's the legacy or the impact you want to have as part of that brand, and build it much more broadly than just like the small group of people that you're working with. And that authenticity, I think, is pretty critical. Almost all of my career only ever been directly recruited for, not really had to, you know, be as active looking for roles, in large part because of who I'm known as and the reputation that I've built. And then again, as I said, it's okay that it's going to change and evolve over time. And sometimes you're even going to make missteps. That mask that I wore early on, I actually had to pivot and like over-rotate because people knew me in one way. And I'm like, that's not really me. I've been wearing this mask. I've been afraid. So I actually had to start to be really different to kind of be the kind of leader that I wanted to be known for, that I knew he was in there, but clearly wasn't coming out the right way.
Well, speaking of pivoting, I believe at one point you had kind of gotten the nickname Iron Maiden, and that was something that you were not okay with. So how did you pivot from that? How did you, you know, change hearts?
Yeah, so that comes from a couple of things we've spoken about. So one is I didn't show a lot of emotion or vulnerability, even though I'd go home. I mean, my nickname is turtle. My best friend calls me that because I do have a tough exterior. I can shoulder a lot, but I'm like, I cry at, you know, the Sarah McLachlan singing at Humane Society commercials, right? Like I'm all mush inside. I'm super soft inside, but I would never show that. And so I've been a part of so many business transformations. And sadly, I've had to impact people's career and livelihood more times than I care to ever have to admit or experience. And for the right business reasons. And I didn't show that. So that's how I got that nickname. So for me, I needed to, one, be incredibly self-reflective. Like there's a reason why people called me that. And so I had to look at the woman that stared back at me in the mirror and say, I'd rather follow someone into the fire than be fearful of being forced, right? And so I want to be the kind of leader that's followed and not feared. And so I would have to do things differently. And for me, that meant I had to lean into a number of things that made me really uncomfortable. So some of them relatively simple. I wouldn't say all of this is simple, but like being all business all the time, let's, instead of like walking into the conference room and go diving right into the agenda, stop for 5 minutes. Let's just talk and engage. Let me understand, what did you do this weekend? Like, how's your family? All these kinds of things. So that would be one. That was the simpler one. Two, I needed to share more openly with people and recognize that it was okay to be vulnerable with people. That was not easy because, you know, that there's great fear, or was for me, and around being vulnerable. But two, I always lived with this fear of being rejected. And in this case, if I'm showing you this deepest emotion and you reject me, like that's crushing. So I had to just get really comfortable with doing what was making me really uncomfortable until it started to feel more natural. And I realized that like people were way more accepting of me by being like authentic like that. And even there was one small thing too. I was not like comfortable. I'm now this like gregarious woman that stands on stages, but like I wasn't always like this. And even like small talk, like I moved from in college, I worked for like a bank and business to consumer. And yes, I was a leader at that point. But when I moved into the world of business to business and thrust into business conferences and going and networking with people and small talk, I was like, oh my God, I'm like, this was horrible. Now I've done it so much that I force myself to do it. It's like totally innate. And I like talk to strangers in elevators. Like, so force yourself to like, you know, lean into the things that are really making you uncomfortable. I truly think that the growth isn't going to come if you're not challenged.
Yeah, I can certainly relate. I'm an introvert by nature. I am also in business to business. So I force myself out there to do it. And my husband comments on it. He'll say, it's, you know, it's like you flip a switch and suddenly you're just a different person and you sound so natural and you can talk to people. And he's like, I can't do that. And he's the one who looks like an extrovert. He's actually a dance teacher and he can do the same thing, but he doesn't like to acknowledge that he can. But I completely can relate to business, especially you get a lot of no's. You can get people that are really just rude for no reason to be rude. We're all kind of in the same boat. It doesn't hurt to just be polite to somebody.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Like,
what can you say? So any parting words, anything that you'd like to bring up, to mention?
The one thing, you know, I would say is going back to sort of the current environment we're in, and for a lot of your audience are younger. And I like to think I had a very supportive mother who gave me great advice when I came out to her. And as a queer woman, I was clearly supportive for Jordan. I know many of your listeners and many people out there don't have that. And to find and reach out to people like us, whether it's through, you know, this podcast and others, find your people. And even if you're in like, you agree with, you know, Ron DeSantis or Abbott in Texas or whatever, like reach out, go outside of city and state and find your people, because you will. So I would say that. And then in terms of stepping into their own, again, I encourage a lot of authenticity. Again, I recognize there's going to be some cities and places that's going to be a challenge. And I always want people to be safe, but be authentic and find that support. I sign a lot of my social media posts like hashtag unstoppable, and because that's my philosophy. And so figure out what being unstoppable is for you. You define it. You define what success looks like for you. But to do that, I will leave with a little bit we talked about around fear. I have this favorite quote, and it's by George Adair, and it says, "Everything you've ever wanted lives on the other side of fear." So I actually had that posted. And so in the moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, can I do this? Yes, Victoria. Yes, you can. Let's step past the fear. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, everybody, that was Victoria. And thank you guys for joining us. If you'd like to be on the next episode of the LGBT Family and Games Community Podcast, make sure to go to discord.gg/LGBTFam. You can join the community. We have over 4,000 members there. You can submit questions that can be asked in the next podcast episodes or topics that you want us to discuss. And until next time, you can also find Victoria at victoria-peltier.com. We'll have that in the description. We'll post all her information, including a link to the book, which, like I said, it was a great book, has a bunch of different successful people in it. But until then, thank you guys.